Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is a possible COVID-19 vaccine. With me to discuss the process of developing and distributing a vaccine for the coronavirus is Dr. Luciana Borio. Lou is a senior fellow for global health at the Council. She is also the vice president at InQtel, a nonprofit strategic investment firm that works to identify and deliver innovative technology solutions to the U.S. intelligence community. From 2017 to 2019, she served as director for medical and biodefense preparedness at the National Security Council, where she was a member of the NSC's pandemic response team. Before that, she was the acting chief scientist of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and the assistant commissioner for counterterrorism policy. Lou earned her medical degree from Georgetown University, completing a residency in internal medicine, and she has done fellowships in infectious diseases and critical care medicine. Now, Lou, after reading your credentials, I feel incredibly inadequate, but thanks for joining us on the President's Inbox.
Thank you for having me today. My pleasure to be here with you.
Now, I have to note up front, you are a real doctor, as my children would describe it, and you're a medical doctor, but you are not dispensing medical advice on this podcast. People should refer to their own physicians and all the rest of the lawyerly contract language you should insert here. So I just wanted to say that up front.
Thank you.
I want to begin by talking about the vaccine, and there's a lot of talk about vaccines hitting the market. We have had the Russians say they already have a vaccine. Chinese and Western firms have a variety of candidate vaccines in various trials at this point. President Trump has talked about vaccines being available by election day, and that seems pretty fast. So maybe you could cut through the clutter for us and tell us a little bit about where we actually stand in the race to get a vaccine.
Sure. You know, actually, we are in a very wonderful place with respect to the science that is underpinning vaccine development, the speed with which things are moving. To put things in perspective, you know, most vaccines will take between 10 to 15 years to develop, and the success rate is typically pretty low. It's about 6% or so. And the reason why, you know, for COVID vaccines, things have been moving so fast, I'll credit the advances in technology over the years, significant investments by the U.S. government in modern platform technologies, the compression of timelines where feasible, and importantly, you know, the great financial risk that the U.S. government has taken to support the scale-up of vaccine manufacturing production, even before we know that they'll work. So you can see that things are moving very quickly. And also, luckily, you know, there is a lot of information in the science literature from other coronaviruses, well, that has affected us in previous years, such as SARS-CoV-1, as well as the MERS-CoV virus. So the scientists were able to move pretty quickly. You know, it may be helpful, though, Jim, to just think about the two big categories of vaccines, because there's so many in development. And I think that it's just helpful to organize them. There, you know, it's not that complicated. There are two main buckets of vaccines.
You'll take it easy. Remember, my doctorate's in philosophy, not in medicine.
Yeah, so let me give it a try. The two big buckets are the gene-based vaccines. And these deliver little gene sequences that encode a certain protein or antigen, which once in the host cell, the human, they then express this protein or antigen, which will generate the immune response against the virus. The other bucket is the protein-based vaccine, which either consists of the inactivated virus itself, whole virus, or little bits of it. So the protein-based vaccines, the protein is being given to the host, the human, and it generates the antibody response that is thought to be protective. The, you know, Moderna and Pfizer that we have heard so much about in the news, these are gene-based vaccines, and they basically are little bits of gene, mRNA, that are administered to the host, and then the protein of interest is expressed inside the human, and that generates an immune response. It was a very quick development path. Moderna, for example, was able to go to the clinic, to phase one clinical studies within 66 days of the gene being sequenced.
But they had been working on a vaccine like this or for a coronavirus for a while, right? It wasn't that somebody started in March, hey, we should probably think up something.
That's right. So that's, you know, the only reason why we are where we are today is because we've had, you know, many years of investments in these types of technologies. And I'll credit, you know, DARPA for a lot of this.
Yeah, that's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, if I recall
yes.
That correctly. Okay, DARPA helped fund some of this.
That's right. And then we have other vaccines that are also considered gene-based, so the AstraZeneca and as well as the Johnson & Johnson. But instead of inserting the little piece of gene, they actually rely on a viral vector, a viral backbone, but the same concept. Yep. You know, the antigen of interest is expressed in the host cell, and that generates the immune response.
Okay, so as we look at this, let's assume that we're going to get a vaccine at some point. I guess the question then becomes one of how effective it will be and how safe it will be. And maybe you could sort of walk us through each of those possible ways of thinking about a vaccine.
Yeah. So the first thing is to make sure that we get the basics correct, like right. I mentioned to you that there's been a lot of science done for related coronavirus. So we knew early on, scientists knew that the spike protein in the coronavirus was very important because the spike protein is what the virus uses to go inside the host cell and causes all the havoc that we know about. So anything that can neutralize its spike protein is thought to be the way to go for a vaccine that will prevent the virus from actually entering the host cell. Details matter, and it took a lot of time to be able to get, you know, what it's a complex big protein, has many different little bits. The scientists had to say, this is the one that we really want to induce antibodies against. So once that was done, these vaccines generally go into phase one clinical studies, and they're very small studies. And the purpose of those small studies are twofold. One is to assess the initial safety testing. And I don't like the name safety because such small numbers, it doesn't really allow us to assess safety. What it really does, it allows us to assess how reactogenic. Is it a vaccine that's giving me a very, you know, sore arm, fever, chills, systemic symptom? Does it make me feel really sick? And sometimes these may not even be consequential, but they don't feel good for the person who takes it. And also to be able to identify a dose. What is the dose that is inducing the right, what we think is the right level of immune response, and is the right immune response? So once scientists complete the phase one studies, they then can go on to larger studies, which are then used to assess whether it's actually having a clinical impact. Is it preventing infection? Is it preventing disease? And you also begin to gather more safety data. I think it's a really important point to make is that just because a vaccine can induce an immune response, an antibody response, it does not mean that it's going to be protective. You know, it's not that hard to induce an immune response. What's really hard is to induce a protective one. And there's no way around but the large-scale clinical studies that are being undertaken. These studies, in the case of COVID, these studies are about 30,000 individuals for each vaccine, although Johnson & Johnson is going even bigger for 60,000 individuals because they want to get there faster. And they also want to have wider representation of the population. But 30,000 is what scientists and statisticians, the number they came up with, to be able to have certain confidence that a vaccine, that the trial is powered to detect a vaccine that is at least 50% effective.
At least 50%.
At least.
That's the target they're mm-hmm. shooting for. Okay.
But he's hoping for more, but that's what the FDA, the bar that they set. So typically, individuals are going to be randomized. Usually, it's a 1-to-1 ratio to receive a placebo vaccine or to receive the vaccine of interest. Everybody's blinded to which vaccine they got, because you can imagine if they knew, that may change their behavior.
Okay.
And that may compromise the results, right? The objective results of the study. And then we begin to count infections in that cohort, the total cohort. So for vaccines like, let's say Moderna, for example, two doses. So the volunteer will take the dose on day one. 4 weeks later, they take the second dose.
So this is like if you're getting a vaccine for shingles. For shingles, you get a shot, then you come back 2 months later and get a second shot. Because not all vaccines are double shot, correct?
Most vaccines initially are double shot. This is a new virus. We don't have too much pre-existing immunity to the specific virus. And it's thought that two doses would be necessary. Although Johnson & Johnson may just need one dose. Their study is planning to just be one dose. But for the Moderna, the Pfizer, AstraZeneca, we're talking about two doses between 3 to 4 weeks apart. And then it begins to count the cases, usually 2 weeks after the second dose, where immunity has already set in. And, you know, we know that if you have about 150 cases in that cohort of 30,000, that should be sufficient to be able to detect whether there is a difference, whether the vaccine is effective or futile, provided that there's a certain distribution of cases, right? We want more cases to occur in the placebo than it occurs in the vaccine group, and we want to have a certain degree of differentiation. But, you know, it's very common to do interim analysis.
Okay, so when we get a vaccine, the hope is it's going to be at least 50% effective. I'm not really sure to the layperson how meaningful that is. And I'll ask the question, I guess, in this context. I saw CDC Director Redfield last week testify that he thought wearing masks would be more effective in stopping the virus than any early vaccine. Can you help me sort of think through that point?
Yeah, so, you know, no vaccine is 100% safe and no vaccine is 100% effective. No vaccine has universal uptake. And we don't even have the ability to vaccinate everybody anyway. And not every vaccine is going to work equally well for different populations. We know that certain people with immunocompromised immune systems or the elderly may not respond so well. So we have to, you know, even though vaccine is the most important and incredible public health tool we have, it's just one tool and it's just not perfect. So we have to really begin to put that in perspective. It is not going to be the end all where we get the vaccine and then we go about to the pre-COVID days. And I think, you know, he was trying to stress about the importance of a layered approach where masks play a very important role, social distancing play a role, avoiding indoor crowded spaces, and that the totality of each of these public health tools will really help us contain the epidemic. And no single tool can do that.
Okay, so the idea then was you would have a vaccine, but you would still potentially wear masks, have your social distancing. We shouldn't think of vaccines as being a magic bullet that solves our problem.
Yeah, it certainly won't be that right away. It'll take a lot of time to ramp up. And we don't know right now, for example, how long the protection, if we achieve that, will last, whether how complete it will be.
Do we even have a sense, Lou, as what the range may be? I mean, because I think, you know, I guess I just had to get a shot, booster shot for tetanus. I guess every 10 years, your doctor wants you to get a new shot and make sure your arm is sore. So are we thinking that these vaccines might work, you know, 10 years like a tetanus shot, a year like the flu shot? Nobody actually knows, and we're going to find out through trial and error.
You know, we don't know yet, but we do know that immunity to coronaviruses in general are not so long lasting. So there's an expectation that if this works, that this vaccine will end up being something that people receive on a periodic basis.
So more like the flu shot, let's say, than the polio shot.
That's right. More like a flu shot. But it may be every, you know, 2 or 3 years. Right. We don't know. It's very difficult to say right away. And also, we don't know whether everybody should receive one or whether it's going to be more recommended for certain populations. It's just too soon. There's so many unknowns. Those are the non-compressible timelines.
So those are the things you can't get around. You know, time can't be compressed. Well, let's talk about this issue of vaccine uptake. Because I imagine even though a lot's being done right now to sort of prepare for us to hit the ground running once the FDA, and I believe it's the FDA that would approve a vaccine so you could get a lot of shots out there. And this is a country of 325 million people. I can't imagine you're going to be able to get a vaccine out to everybody right away. So what is the thinking on who should get the vaccine first and in what order it should proceed? Do we have an agreement on that?
We don't yet, because we don't know exactly what the vaccine is going to look like and who is it going to benefit the most, whether it's going to even work in the populations that are the most vulnerable to this. So the CDC recently, the committee that usually makes recommendations, it's called ACIP, for which population should receive a vaccine first, which one should prioritize. They table the discussion until they have more information about the vaccine. And, you know, it's a really very important point because we already have a background of vaccine hesitancy in the population. And the politicization around COVID vaccine development can further exacerbate the situation. And if you have a lot of physicians and scientists who are normally very pro-vaccine, hesitant to recommend it to their patients, that's going to create a very significant problem. So it's very important that the system is not politicized and that the FDA is given the authority and the freedom to make the decisions that are in the best interest. You know, I mentioned to you earlier about the interim analysis, and there's some anxiety about this at this point because, you know, Pfizer CEO has gone on the record saying that he's in a rush to submit a request for the FDA for an emergency authorization and that he's going to have data very quickly based on these interim analysis. You know, the trial is blinded. So the only people that have access to the data to see which way it's working with respect to safety or efficacy is the DSMB, the Data Safety and Monitoring Board. Periodically, they'll take a peek at the data and see if the infections, you know, who's getting those infections. Is it the placebo group? Is it the vaccine group? And if the vaccine is extraordinarily effective, it's possible that we could ascertain that with very few numbers of infections in that total cohort. For example, even though the final analysis is going to require 164 cases in that cohort of 30,000 that I mentioned, now it's going to be 140,000, actually. They expanded their trial. But the first interim analysis occurs after after 32 cases of COVID in that total cohort. They'll take a peek.
Is this what we saw, Lou, in the AstraZeneca instance in which they halted the program for a while? Because I believe a woman came down with some kind of spinal infection that was atypical, and then they checked things and they resumed the trial. So when you're doing these tests, you're periodically reviewing the data?
That's right. So the Data Safety Monitoring Board, if it's a serious adverse event that gets reported immediately, it doesn't even wait until a certain number of infections occur for the scheduled meeting. And in that case, there was a recommendation to pause the study. As you know, it's still paused in the US. It's resumed in the UK. But I wanted to go back to this 32 cases, because I think it's really important that, you know, if you have 32 cases in the first interim analysis and 26 of those occur in the placebo, and only 6 occur in the vaccine group, that's what it would be sufficient, according to the statistical plan, to declare victory that early. And I think that's when they're counting on saying, well, it's victory, so let's go and do an EUA, but not so fast. Because the point is that there's a lot of information that is still lacking by that point. And the FDA is then saying, listen, we need to have more safety data. We want to have more information on diverse populations, on the elderly. We want to make sure that we get a few weeks of safety data after the second dose. We want to make sure that the vaccine is not causing enhanced disease, which is a worse outcome in certain people. So, you know, it's very tricky to be able to balance the communications around the urgency and the speed with which we're going to get there, but also the recognition that vaccines are given to healthy people, and that we need to really double down on this issue of, you know, getting the data that we need to be able to build a safety database and then provide people with the confidence they need to accept the vaccine.
Well, I take your point on sort of the importance of the public and its willingness to take the vaccine. I would say on that front, public opinion polling is not encouraging on that score. Earlier in the summer, roughly 70% of Americans said they'd be willing to take an early version of an approved vaccine. The numbers by, I guess, the beginning of this month, polls showing 50% or even less than that among the public in terms of taking the vaccine. I assume some of that has to do with the concerns about whether we're going too fast and whether corners are being cut in the potential politicization of the process. Now, again, the FDA has to handle this problem. You work there. To what extent are you concerned as a doctor, as an FDA alum, as someone who may want to take the vaccine down the road, by the chance for politicization?
Yeah, and I won't sugarcoat the fact that I've been, you know, very disappointed in some recent decisions that the FDA has made with respect to EUAs for hydroxychloroquine, convalescent plasma, you know, some mismanagement early on in diagnostic tests. But I have to say that the Office of Vaccines Research and Review, which is actually where I began my career at the FDA, I was a vaccine reviewer. They are one of the most incredible staff that FDA has. They're very lucky to have them. It's a very diverse, highly capable, expert staff with tremendous experience in reviewing and assessing vaccines and regulating vaccines. They are a cohesive group. So in terms of my confidence about their work, I completely stand by their work, all the way from each medical officer to the office director and deputy director. It's a treat to watch them work, to see, you know, how this all takes shape by such a multidisciplinary and expert team. The problem is that their recommendations may not be upheld. And that's the question that we are going to have to observe in the coming weeks. Their job is very, very challenging, but I'm confident that, again, they do have our backs and they do have the public health interest at heart. They have the experience and the expertise to make the right decisions.
Putting the question aside, Lou, of whether people will be willing to take a vaccine, particularly in the early days, is there any guidance or any lessons we can draw from past epidemics about what a smart strategy for distributing vaccines might be? Is it important to target healthcare workers, for example, first, or maybe the elderly because they seem to have a much more catastrophic reaction or a higher likelihood of having a catastrophic reaction to COVID-19? Or is it the case that we're going to get so many doses so quickly that we don't really need to make sort of those fine level distinctions about who should be eligible for a vaccine?
You know, I'm glad you raised this question because, you know, we've been so domestically focused in our programs to develop vaccines. It is true that possibly for the U.S., there will be an excess of vaccines early on because we're manufacturing large scale. If everything goes well, according to plan, if there are no hurdles in the manufacturing process, which is complicated to scale up this fast, it's possible that we'll have, you know, hundreds of millions of doses by early next year. And we may not be in such a bind to be able to prioritize, even though normally people that are at the highest risk of exposure or highest risk of complication from the disease are the ones that are prioritized. But globally, demand will exceed supply. And we live in this interconnected world, you know, so it is very important to not just have an inward domestic focus on access to this vital commodity, because it is in our best interest for security purposes, but also for economic purposes, to be able to have the world get to the other side of this pandemic as quickly as possible.
So let me ask you that. How do you think about the international aspect of it? Because I take your point about our all being interconnected. You could have somebody passing through an airport somewhere in Asia, somewhere in the Middle East, somewhere in Europe, coming into contact with somebody who is contagious. They get in a plane, 8-14 hours later, they're here in the United States. They could end up passing the virus along. And that's how the virus came here in the first place. So how do you think about helping other countries that may not have the wherewithal to do this? I mean, obviously, you know, affluent countries, Western Europe, I think Japan, have well-advanced health infrastructures and in the capacity to make sure their people get vaccinated, but that leaves a large chunk of the world probably not having that capacity.
Yeah, and you know, sadly, the U.S. has actually done a lot to contribute to the global effort, but it hasn't articulated its contributions, right? The substantial investments in technology and vaccine development are helping the global response. The fact that a lot of the companies that the U.S. government is funding, like AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson and Novavax, these are companies that are producing vaccine internationally for the international audience. And again, it wouldn't have been so strong without the U.S. contribution, but we haven't really articulated the good that is happening as a result of these investments. And we haven't also, you know, made significant monetary contributions to COVAX. COVAX was established by WHO and Gavi and CEPI to help low and middle income countries to be able
to... You know, Gavi is the Global Alliance
for Vaccine Initiative.
You dropped a lot of acronyms on me there, and I should have written them all down. But these are organizations that are very active on this front and working on health issues globally, and they've come together on this topic. But the United States is not part of COVAX, at least officially.
The U.S. is not, and neither is China or Russia. Right. And, you know, they have about 159 countries that have signed on to COVAX, covering about 2/3 of the world population. So they're really making some significant progress. And they expect to have about 2 billion doses by the end of 2021, which would be sufficient to vaccinate the populations that you mentioned, Jim, like healthcare workers, those who are highest risk of disease.
Well, I would imagine that would be particularly important because healthcare workers may be the most critical link in the chain here, because if healthcare workers become ill or die from the disease, you've lost the people who can help prevent many other people from becoming sick.
That's right. The fastest way to reduce the global burden is to protect those that are most vulnerable to complications, and to healthcare workers absolutely are top of the list.
So let me ask you, Lou, sort of looking at the WHO, which we just mentioned a moment ago, do you think there have been any harmful repercussions from President Trump's decision to leave the WHO? Because he argues that it's too closely aligned with China and hasn't taken seriously the severity of the COVID-19 pandemic.
You know, I will be the first to acknowledge WHO is not a perfect organization. It has significant limitations. But one thing that really is upsetting is to completely, I guess, disentangle ourselves from WHO, knowing very well that WHO is able to do work that we absolutely can't do. And of course, the U.S. has been absent from a leadership voice in this pandemic internationally. And that's been pretty striking as well. You know, when I was at the NSC staff, we were dealing with an Ebola epidemic in the DRC, and there were areas of significant conflict and Beni and all. And we really just couldn't place our healthcare workers, our epidemiologists, and our teams on the ground. And we had to rely on WHO to do that work. So, you know, the U.S. was providing technical assistance, intellectual support, but we were just not on the ground. This idea that we can completely detach from an organization that is responsible for doing very hard work to protect the global health and to protect our shores is disturbing, to say the least. And, you know, I'll just say one more thing, that, you know, around the table of all the meetings that I've been, there was a disproportionate number of Americans around the table. And part of it is because they really value the expertise. But that gave us an opportunity to really set the standards. And we have incredible high standards for science and public health and medicine. Without the U.S. presence, there will be a significant gap in the technical abilities for WHO.
Lou, I want to switch gears and talk about testing in therapeutics. We've talked about vaccines to this point, but I take your insight earlier on that vaccines are not the only thing we should be thinking about. Are there any developments happening on the testing or therapeutic front that may be significant to how this disease plays out, either in terms of limiting transmission or preventing some of the more catastrophic outcomes for people who contract COVID-19?
I think we're doing a lot better on the testing, but not because, you know, we would have gotten faster where we are if we had a more coordinated response and national strategy for leveraging and deploying all of our diagnostic assets at the, you know, at the national level. We lack this coordination. On the other hand, we're beginning to see very creative solutions and deployment of approaches that nobody would have considered pre-COVID. So colleges and campuses are doing, you know, very massive testing to protect their students and the workforce. And that seems to be, you know, it's complicated. And part of whether they can succeed or not has to do with the frequency with which they test, has to do with the prevalence in the population to begin with, and the social behavior of people that are within that, you know, big bubble. But there's some that have achieved significant success with this strategy. There's also this idea of pool testing. So in areas of very low prevalence or nursing homes, for example, that are trying to maintain cases out, there's idea that you can, you know, basically pull all the specimens and do the analysis. And if only if it's positive, you have to go back and retest individuals. If not, it can clear the whole batch. And that allows, you know, creates efficiency in the testing process. There's some really interesting data coming out from testing wastewater. So the person doesn't even have to be bothered by giving a sample because they can just test wastewater. So there's
We don't need to get too graphic here.
And one of my favorites is some companies are not using biology anymore. They are doing a machine learning AI and special microscopy to look if there are changes in the saliva that are consistent with COVID infection. And of course that, you know, it would allow for very rapid screening, very quick, like at airports and all that. I think Heathrow has a pilot. And, you know, it's too soon to know whether this strategy will work. But, you know, it's good to be incorporating cutting-edge science into practice.
So the idea here would be if you were going to go into some public space where there might be a high potential for transmission, you could very quickly determine this person has been infected and hence not let him get on the plane or go into the symphony hall or go into the arena, something like that. Is that the logic here?
That's the logic. And we don't know yet whether these tests are going to be sufficiently, the performance would be, you know, sensitive and specific enough for the use. But it does, you know, really stimulate our imagination for what we could be doing. And diagnostic tests. The technology is out there. It just hasn't been applied or supported over the years as much as technology for vaccines and therapeutics. And eventually we'll get the, you know, the rapid antigen tests, the quick point of care test that can give us results pretty quickly. Their adoption continues to increase as well.
So let me ask you about therapeutics. Is there any breakthroughs? I heard a lot about, I think it's remdesivir, but that seemed to be providing some help to people who were very stricken by the disease. And there's also been some talk about innovative uses of steroids in treating some cases. Anything else promising in the field of therapeutics?
Yeah, so there have been like three types of therapeutics that have been shown to be effective to treat COVID as a when given on the backbone of supportive care. So remdesivir is one of those, as well as baricitinib, which is an immunomodulator. And those are studied in large randomized controlled clinical studies for people with more moderate disease. And then for people with more advanced disease, the steroids have been shown in the UK trials, also pragmatic randomized controlled study that the UK is doing to provide a survival advantage. Those are very exciting. The NIH is studying now.
National Institute of Health?
Yes, our nation's preeminent clinical research agency, and they are studying, they're supporting the studies across academic centers, also studying interferon beta 1A, which is again, works as an antiviral immunomodulatory therapy. The important thing, I think, for the therapeutics is this idea that to find cures quickly, we really need to do randomized controlled studies. And our brain, when we talk about RCTs, our brain says, oh my gosh, that is the gold standard. Therefore, that has to take forever. That must not be efficient. That's too high a bar for a crisis. And the reverse is true. It's actually that it is the most efficient, is the fastest, and the most definitive way. And the remdesivir study, the baricitinib study, they enrolled about 1,000 patients, and they're able to get very clear-cut answers about the benefit of those drugs. In contrast, when we begin to give drugs, you know, to everybody because we think we're in a crisis, we end up with hundreds of thousands of patients sometimes receiving a drug, and we still cannot know, we don't know whether it works or harms. And that's very frustrating.
And Lou, I have to ask this. I hadn't really thought about it before, but I want to ask of you, since you're a practicing physician, how do you get news of new strategies for dealing with COVID-19 to doctors. I mean, there are tens of thousands of doctors around the country, and presumably it's important to get them good information on what works and what doesn't. What's the process for doing it? Is it up to individual hospitals or medical practices to do things? Is there some centralized way of distributing information? How does it all work?
You know, our data management systems need to be improved. You know, the fact that in the middle of this pandemic, hospitals are having to fax information and that availability to FEMA, I think it really is, I don't know what's the best word to use here, maybe disappointing to say the least. This is America, right? We should be able to. But it's a very important point that, you know, this has been an issue with almost every epidemic, whether if it's a small one like anthrax or in the larger ones, clinicians eventually, through their informal channels and through professional societies, begin to coalesce around certain practices. And then you have more formal development of data. So the NIH, for example, has a clinical group that makes very good recommendations about therapies, which ones they recommend, which ones they don't, based on data. They put all the studies together, very experienced individuals. So that's a more formal kind of recommendation body. And of course, CDC, there's other, you know, their recommendations on the public health. But at the end of the day, it's really important to realize that physicians do get to the point where they begin to share information that actually affects care. And the two examples that come to mind is this notion that, you know, they learned that not everybody who even present seriously ill with a low oxygen levels in their blood need to be mechanically ventilated, that they can do just as well with less intensive care. And also this idea that a lot of, they were seeing a lot of thrombosis and clots emerging in these patients. And now that's the topic of there's a very large randomized controlled trial to evaluate many different anticoagulation strategies ongoing, because it seemed that this is like a missing piece in the early care of these patients, you know, the provision of anticoagulation.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Dr. Luciana Borio, Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. Lou, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.